You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Terrorism has been talked about a great deal over the last decade in the mainstream media, and there is widespread agreement on its definition that terrorism is the calculated use of violence to achieve political ends. However, what is left unsaid in the definition is that terrorism is what our enemies engage in. What we do is counterterrorism, and that is, by definition, perfectly okay. On Western Terrorism is a new book by Noam Chomsky and Andrei Vucek. The book is comprised of interviews between the two on subjects ranging from colonialism and imperial control, from propaganda and the media, from the Arab Spring to the decline in U.S. power. Andrei Vucek is a writer, journalist, and filmmaker, and he joins us on the phone from his home in Surabaya, Indonesia, where I understand it is very early in the morning. Hello, Andrei.
Hello, how are you? It's 1 o'clock in the morning, not so late, actually.
Oh, good, good. Now, one thing I noticed immediately when I was reading the book is that this is not so much a standard interview with a question and answer, but more a conversation between equals. So I was wondering, you know, how did you come to meet Professor Chomsky, and how did this project come about?
We know each other for many years, and actually I wrote to him about 20 years ago when I was living in Santiago de Chile, and I had no idea he would reply to me, and he did. So we began very long, very intensive exchange, because at the time I was based in Southern Cone, so I was writing on Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Peru, and not interested, of course, in that part of the world. And it was right after the collapse of the dictatorship in Chile. So actually it was, when was it? Yeah, about 17 years ago. So when I was living there. So he was asking me many practical questions, and I was very interested, of course, in his, I'm a great admirer of his work by then. So we began a very long correspondence over the email.
And how did this particular project, this collection of interviews, come about?
I actually approached this assistant, Beth, and she later told me that many people actually requested this this kind of dialogue, or in other cases, interview. But because our friendship or our exchange was so intensive and so long-lived, Noam actually told his assistant, he told Beth to go ahead and push for this. And it was supposed to be just, first it was supposed to be just a book, but then I decided to make it a film, and my Japanese crew from Tokyo flew to Boston, and it was recorded. Now it was already published in London by Pluto, and we are still they're finishing the film in Tokyo. It will be probably released in about 2 to 3 months from now.
Now, you begin the book with what to me was a very startling fact, that there's over 50 million people have died since the end of World War II as a result of Western colonialism and neocolonialism. How does the West get away with these crimes?
Well, first of all, let me just mention that this number didn't come from the blue. I worked with several professional statisticians, and we came to the number, we calculated all the crimes from Hiroshima to Indonesian coup in 1965. Of course, the entire war in Indochina, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Africa, crimes against humanity in Africa. We came to the number between 50 and 60 million. And these are people who were murdered or killed directly. Of course, there were hundreds of millions who died indirectly because of the neocolonialism, because of the extreme forms of capitalism, and so on. Well, about the West getting away with these crimes, actually, it always got away with these crimes. So we only talk about the period from the Second World War, from Hiroshima until now. But if you look back at all the Christian crusades and colonialism, we are talking about probably, you know, half of the planet being destroyed in the name of the cross or in the name of the you know, Western values or European values or whatever you want to call it. And sometimes there were no boundaries at all between the religion and economic interests. So this is nothing new, and there is of course this enormous propaganda system which was developed during colonial regimes, usually under the religious cover, and all this is being used now in the even in the 21st century. Of course, the propaganda is very perfect. It's much better than it was centuries ago. And very often people in the West don't even realize that the propaganda exists or that it is what is being fed to them. You know, the good example, for example, is that you go to Belgium, you go to Brussels, and you still have statues of King Leopold II. And this is the man who killed 10 million people in what is today Democratic Republic of Congo. So, you know, it's not being even questioned today. His statues are all over the place. You know, the subway station is named after him, and so on.
Now, one of the chapters in the book, too, is on India and China. One, of course, is nominally democratic, and the other is communist. How do you and Professor Chomsky compare the two countries?
Well, I'm familiar with both places. I speak very often in China. I work in China. Intensively, and so I do in India, and of course the contrast is absolutely striking, and it takes great discipline, and one has to be really blind not to see the difference. I mean, the centrally planned China is way ahead, you know, by decades ahead of India, and the destruction of now, people in India, the West calls India democratic society. Of course, it's not. If you go to India, to the countryside where majority of Indians live, and you talk to the people there, you realize that they vote in accordance to what you know, what they are being told. Very often they are being bribed. The heads of the villages still have very. It's a strongly feudal system there. There's a caste system, there is a feudal system, and so on. And there is a great disinformation, and people are, of course, very badly educated as compared to China. So Noam was mentioning several works which compared the number of people who were killed, let's say, in the Great Famine in China, and then in India under the simple mismanagement. And they're probably talking about tens of millions of people who died in India just from mismanagement, probably more. So I would say that definitely the system, no matter what the Western propaganda says, the Chinese system is much less brutal towards the common citizens than the Indian system.
Now, of course, you're based in Indonesia, and I was very interested towards the end of the book. There's a brief conversation you have about Barack Obama, who spent some of his youth in Indonesia. Obama is generally described as something of a liberal, but that contrasts a bit with the environment in Indonesia that he would have grown up in. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, actually, I'm based in Japan, and I'm based in Kenya and in Indonesia. I'm Indonesian, so I do write in Indonesia quite a lot. Interesting thing, because I'm based in Kenya, in Nairobi, and also in Indonesia. These are two places where Barack Obama is very closely connected to. As I often say, it is quite clear that he was a product of the intelligence, and also his father who was Kenyan. He was actually one of the economists who helped to destroy, together with Tom Boyer, destroy the socialist wing of the government of Kenyatta, of young Kenyan state. And then in Indonesia, it was the same, because after his father died and his mother, they divorced, his mother remarried, and young Obama went to Indonesia because his mother married an army officer, Indonesian army officer, who was just going through the period of indoctrination in Hawaii. So they went, he was called back to Indonesia just about a few months after the horrible coup in Indonesia, which took place in 1965, in which between 2 and 3 million people died. So it was a purge of communists, atheists, intellectuals, artists, everything. So, you know, his stepfather was actually an army officer who was taking, who was participating in these terrible events. And Barack Obama was growing up in a compound, in a military compound in the neighborhood of Menteng in Jakarta, which is now a very posh one. But in his days, it was middle, upper middle class, and he was you know, he was probably very much aware of what was going on, because although it was not super luxury neighborhood, so he knew you know, this was period when the rivers were still clogged with corpses and all that. And he's talking very fondly about his childhood. He's actually, you know, he hardly mentions anything very negative about Indonesia. So of course, it is very disturbing fact.
Now, about the recent past in Indonesia over the last few decades, of course, you mentioned that the coup in the 1960s. In particular, I was wondering about Indonesia's relationship with Australia. Can you talk about that, too?
Well, again, Australia was very close ally, is always very close ally of the United States. And the official policy of Australia was always very closely linked to the to that of the United States, which supported the coup directly. I mean, the U.S. embassy actually handed to the Indonesian military entire list of the people who had to be killed. And of course, the military and the religious cadres went overboard, and they killed thousands times more than it was expected from them. Australia held the same line. It gave the clean support to the coup. It later encouraged invasion to East Timor in 1975, in which about 30% of the East Timorese people were murdered by Indonesian forces, of which present government and present president of the of Indonesia was actually one of the commanders. So this is never discussed in the Western media. You know, this guy is called a Democrat. So so Australia is actually one of the countries that is very supportive of the Indonesian regime, which exists until now. And some Australian universities, like Australian National University, ANU, keeps producing reports that try to portray Indonesia as, quote, a normal state, unquote. So there is a very, you know, there is a very close, there is a very close link. Both countries are, of course, capitalist, and Indonesia is seen as a very reliable partner in against China and during the Vietnam War as well. So it's definitely a very close relationship between Australia and Indonesia for understandable reasons.
Now, in the last section of the book, that's titled The Decline of U.S. Power. Now, I got the impression that you and Professor Chomsky think things a little bit differently. Is that right?
Noam is an optimist, and I think I'm a little bit more pessimistic about the situation, the global situation. Actually, we had some disagreements even about the Arab Spring, because Noam believed that Arab Spring is actually similar to what was happening in Latin America some 10 years ago. I was criticizing Arab Spring, saying that there is no solidarity between the countries. And actually what happened is that I worked in Egypt on several occasions and made a film about Egypt of Christa. And it's just obviously the Arab Spring is on decline. It was totally derailed by the West. Some believe that it's going to prevail, that it's going to be strong enough to withstand the influences from the West. But unfortunately, what we saw in Egypt recently proved that the empire is still incredibly strong, and it's capable of manipulating in politics in these countries. You know, in Egypt, they basically manipulated Muslim Brotherhood's government of Morsi, and then they supported the coup, the military coup, which is now bringing the Mubarak's regime or the essence of Mubarak's regime back to the country. So we disagreed there, and as I said, no, I absolutely respect his opinions, and I agree with him on like 95%. But this, the optimism that he feels for the future of the planet, and to believe that the Western power is declining, I don't share it, because I really think that it's in fact the power is quite consolidated through propaganda and through other means. Like a very shocking thing was in China. I spoke at Tsinghua University, which is one of the most important universities in China. They were running a seminar on my work for 2 days. And professors and students actually told me that the biggest problem China is now facing is the propaganda from the West. That they believe it. Suddenly the infiltration of the Western propaganda is so powerful that Chinese intellectuals very often don't believe that the West committed any crimes. There was a case of some mainstream academia book being translated to Chinese about the colonialism in America, and the book just, you know, it was not even left-wing, it was a normal academic book which claimed that there was a certain amount of people who died during the colonialism process, and apparently the publishing house in China was flooded with emails and letters protesting, saying we had enough of this anti-Western propaganda. Actually, you know, this never happened. I mean, what? They never killed millions of people during the colonial process. So this is how far the propaganda goes. And China is a very educated country. I mean, it's in the big cities like Beijing or Shanghai. The crowd is very educated. And even they are absolutely, you know, influenced by the propaganda coming from the West. And without, you know, breaking this cycle of Western propaganda and indoctrination that is being the whole world is being bombarded by it, you know, from Africa to Asia to Latin America. Without breaking this cycle, there is no way that there can be any progress.
Now, in the introduction, I described you as a journalist, primarily, and a filmmaker, but you are also a novelist. Is that right? Can you tell us about
your... Yes, of course. Yeah. This is my main claim to fame, so to say.
And what is your latest project?
Well, I'm working on 1,000-page novel now, which is called Winter Journey, and it's basically quite similar in fiction terms project that we did with Noam, and basically consolidating all the crimes committed by the West into the stories of different women from different parts of the world. But it's a novel. It's a very powerful, very scary novel, and it's actually the list. In artistic way, actually, it's a list of the most horrific crimes committed in the last decades by the West. Because I believe in political fiction. You know, I mean, there has to be a love story, there has to be fun, there has to be the novel has to be naughty, it has to be entertaining, everything. But I believe that it has to be political, and all great novels were. So I don't think novel is entertainment. So this is what I'm writing now, and my latest novel, Point of No Return, is available all over all outlets like Amazon and whatever. It is actually about Latin American Revolution, and there's some very deep autobiographical elements, because I lived in South America for many years and participated or covered the revolutions and got very close to the people who were making them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today, Andre.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show.
I've been speaking to Andre Vucek, a writer and filmmaker based in Indonesia. He is the author, with Noam Chomsky, of On Western Terrorism, just out in Canada from Between the Lines Press. A link to Andre's website, as well as a link to the trailer for the companion film to the book, On Western Terrorism, can be found at our website, which is cooperadio.org/redeye.